relaxing. Lloyd did not get up. "Mr. Regal, welcome to Chateau Laurent." Regal was angry.
"Did it not occur to you to mention to the guards I would be arriving? I've had 3 Belarusians just tell me they almost fired on my transport."
"That would have been unfortunate." Regal looked like he was going to continue the argument, but instead, he let it go.
"Where is Abu Bakr's representative?"
"Mr. Felix is downstairs. We've put him up in a room adjacent to the library. I told him I'd call down if I had news."
"You heard Gentry slip through the noose again?"
"I heard."
"We have Geneva covered, though. If he turns up there, we will get him."
"So you continue to say."
"We may not have dropped him dead in a street with one shot, but we are beating him down with simple wear and tear. He will run out of weapons, ammunition, escape routes, time, and blood before long."
"Hope you're right. I'm running out of hostages." Regal sat down in the text chair.
"As I told you on the phone en route, Marc Laurent has ordered me here to provide on-site consultation. Don't look at me like that. I don't want to be here any more than you want me. This fucking mess you've created and exacerbated will not help my career, regardless of the outcome. I am just the cleaner, the man to keep a terrible situation from becoming worse. When Laurent heard about the hostage being shot by a guard, well, he just said, 'Kurt, get over there. Do what you have to do.'"
Lloyd's response was tinged with tired sarcasm. "Monsieur Laurent needn't worry. I doubt it will happen again. No more daddies to die here."
"Where is the Fitzroy family now?"
"Locked in a room downstairs on the 2nd floor."
"Do they know about the shooting?"
"Kids don't. Mom does."
"What is her demeanor?"
"One of my close protection detail injected her with enough sedative to keep her docile for a while." Regal just nodded.
"And where is Sir Donald?"
Lloyd motioned to a door across the room. "In there."
"How did the shooting occur?"
Lloyd shrugged. He seemed momentarily disinterested in the entire operation. "One of the little shits made a run for it. Sniper on the roof saw her and radioed down. I was busy at the time. My radio was off. When the guards took off after her, Phil went nuts. Thought they were going to hurt her, I guess. He barreled over 2 armed Minsk boys in the hallway, shot out the back door to get his daughter."
"And?"
"And the sniper took him out."
Regal looked out the window to the back lawn.
"The poor son of a bitch was just trying to protect his family. He'd have brought her back. He wouldn't have run out on the others. No father would ever leave his family behind."
"I don't suppose our sniper is much of a family man."
"Sir Donald knows?"
"Yeah, I told him."
"How'd he take it?"
"No emotion at all. Just sat there."
"All right. I am going to speak to him, try to explain this was an accident."
"Lots of luck."
"Why don't you take a break, Lloyd? You look like shit."
Lloyd stood up. Regal saw the blood on his dress shirt, but said nothing. Lloyd said, "I am still in charge." Kurt Regal shook his head in disbelief.
"Fine by me. I don't want responsibility for any more of this disaster than I have to take on. I am just here to consult. Maybe offer helpful suggestions, like not losing track of 8-year-old girls, and not shooting hostages who pose no danger nor threat of escape, and not forgetting to tell your security that a friendly helicopter will be landing in their midst. Suggestions of that sort."
Lloyd stood and headed for the staircase to the kitchen without a word. Regal crossed the room and opened the door behind which Lloyd said he'd find Sir Donald. The German was surprised to be looking into a large, tiled bathroom. Fitzroy was seated in a chair in the middle of the candlelit chamber. He looked up at Regal with wet and bloodshot eyes. His head and hands and ankles were secured to the chair with thick iron chains. His dress shirt was shredded on the floor next to him. He sat in a sweat and blood-stained undershirt. His face had been beaten, and there were fat splotches of blood on his torn tweed trousers. Kurt Regal took them for puncture marks.
"Scheiße," Regal said.
He stepped out of the room, leaned out into the hall, and called out to the two Scottish guards near the stairs.
I want the prisoner's bindings removed. I want him cleaned up. Bandage his legs. And someone find him fresh clothing. Damn it, man, move!
15 minutes later, Regal sat on a stool by the edge of a canopied bed in the master quarters on the second floor. Sir Donald lay on the bed and stared back at him. The Englishman had been unshackled and cleaned up and dressed in fresh clothes. A wet bandage hung on his left temple where an ineffective blow had cut his skin. The bruises on his chin and eyes had received little attention. Neither man spoke at first, although Fitzroy had declined coffee with a shake of his head. His eyes hung low and malevolent. Finally, Regal found a starting place.
Sir Donald, my name is Herr Regal. First, allow me to sincerely apologize for your treatment. I had no idea Lloyd was going to... Well, no excuses. I take responsibility for this. I will make it right.
Fitzroy said nothing, though his glare indicated no show of appreciation would be forthcoming.
I have food and water on the way to you. Something heavier, perhaps. A brandy, maybe. You Englishmen often enjoy an afternoon nip. Am I right?
Still no response from the aged prisoner.
Further, my deepest condolences for your son. Nothing I can say or do can... Then don't bloody bother.
Don's voice was sandpaper, gravel.
Understood. I just want you to know. No one intended for this to happen. Again, no excuses. I should have been here on site all along. As soon as I heard about the accident, I was on the way. Your son did what any father would have done.
He should not have been shot.
Then he said again, he only did what any father would have done in such circumstances.
Fitzroy seemed to think about this, but he did not respond.
From now on, I will be overseeing your care and the care of your family. Mr. Lloyd will coordinate the initiative to find and neutralize the Grey Man. I will also be in charge of the defenses here, to make things ready in the unlikely event Mr. Gentry manages to slip past the hunters we have out in the field looking for him. He'll be here soon enough, Fritz.
Regal smiled a little and sat up.
He has managed to neutralize or effect the neutralization of the Albanians, the Indonesians, and the Venezuelans, and the Libyans suffered one inadvertent casualty during his escape from them, meaning he has brought about the complete destruction of 3 kill squads and depleted the manpower of a 4th. Still, there are 9 teams between him and ourselves, 40 men or so, plus 100 pavement artists searching for him, plus a 14-man security detail in cordon here around the chateau, plus a technician here monitoring the phones and computers of all Gentry's known associates along his probable route. And there is word he is injured. Surely he is tired. His resources are thinning. He'll be here.
Fitzroy's voice was matter of fact. The German smiled obligingly.
We'll see.
Then his eyes turned darker.
Sir Donald, you are a professional. Surely you understand your situation. I would only insult your intelligence by telling you we will let you go when this matter with the Grey Man is resolved. You know as well as I that we cannot merely open the gates and let you walk out. Not to be dramatic, but, as they say in the movies, you simply know too much. No. Regardless of the outcome with Gentry and the Lagos contract, you will not be leaving Chateau Laurent with your life. Ah, you knew that. I am glad to see this in your eyes. But I will make this promise between two professionals. The twins and your daughter-in-law will not be harmed. They have gone through enough. I just need to keep them here until Mr. Gentry's arrival. Then, they are free. As long as the Grey Man does not contact others, bring police or military down upon our little chateau here, there will be no danger to the woman and her daughters, regardless of whether or not President Abu Bakr signs the contract. I also promise you will suffer no more indignities at the hands of Mr. Lloyd.
Fitzroy nodded and lifted his chin.
I want my son's body respected. It goes without saying. I'll see a proper casket is brought in. We'll ferry Philip back to Britain via helicopter. He will be delivered to the place of his wife's choosing as soon as she returns home.
Fitzroy nodded slowly.
You do that, and you find a way to keep the girls out of the line of fire when the Grey Man shows up tonight, and I will be in your debt and be no trouble to your mission.
When the Grey Man shows up tonight, Riggle fought a little smile and won.
You have my word as a gentleman. Anything else I can do for you to make you more comfortable until the battle for the castle?
He could not help a little sarcasm.
I would very much like to speak with Claire, if I could. A bit of a worrier she is. I hate to think what is going on in her head right now. Just a little chat between grandfather and his granddaughter in private. Claire is one of the twins. I am sure I can see to that. That would be lovely, thank you.
10 minutes later, Regal stood across from Lloyd in the kitchen. They both drank coffee and ignored sandwiches on a platter on the large stone island in front of them.
Why did you torture Fitzroy?
He wasn't taking the situation seriously.
You are insane, Lloyd. I presume this insanity has been formally diagnosed, maybe back in your childhood, and you managed to hide that detail of your psyche from the CIA and Marc Laurent.
Sticks and stones, Regal.
Leave Fitzroy alone.
You have a bigger problem than me, Kurt. We need an asset in Switzerland to clean up the mess Gentry created.
Meaning?
The tech just got word from a watcher in Lausanne. Tells us two of the Venezuelan operators were taken alive by the Swiss. We need assurances that they won't talk.
So you want them killed?
How else can we be certain of their silence?
Regal shrugged.
Without Laurent Group, Venezuela's oil stops flowing. Without Laurent Group, what oil they have for export doesn't make it across the sea to the refineries. Chavez needs us as much as we need him. A couple of shooters who could neither manage to succeed in their mission nor die trying will not jeopardize the good relationship we have with that lunatic. I'll make a call to the director of the General Intelligence Office in Caracas. Let him know that even though they failed in their mission, I'll send him a consolation prize if he sees that his agents keep their mouths shut.
When the Swiss allow officials from the Venezuelan embassy to meet with the two surviving operators in jail.
I have no doubt the message those two bastards will get will be very descriptive in what will happen to their families back home if they don't take the fall for the operation. One mentioned by them to the police of a multinational corporation's recruitment of several Third World Intelligence Agency's hit squads to kill a man traversing Europe and, well, those men's wives, kids, parents, and neighbors will be tossed into the Venezuelan version of a gulag.
Lloyd was impressed. That's one reason you didn't use mercenaries, isn't it?
Mercenaries don't have anyone to answer to but themselves. I much prefer using men who are subject to other avenues of influence that I can manipulate.
Lloyd nodded. So now we just have to find Gentry.
We have Laurent Group assets at every choke point in Geneva, every location of a known associate, every hospital. We have phones and police radios monitored by the tech here. We have the South Africans in the city center ready for deployment. If one of my watchers sees the Grey Man, he will have a hit squad on him in 15 minutes.
Fitzroy had not eaten, though he'd sucked down 2 brandies and some bottled water. The treatment he'd received from Lloyd had left him worse for wear, but unbroken. Knife jabs to the thigh, open-handed strikes to the head. They were the actions of a desperate man, nothing more. As a young intelligence officer working in Ulster in the 70s, Don was kidnapped from a taxi stand by a carload of hooded provos. They took him to a warehouse, spent 90 minutes beating him with lengths of pipe. By the time the SAS Quick Reaction Force fast dropped down from the helicopter, killed 3 of the 5 IRA men in the ensuing gunfight, and the other 2 execution-style against the warehouse wall, The 26-year-old spy had suffered 6 broken bones and permanent reduction in vision in his left eye. The workover he'd received from Lloyd was nothing like that. The American had the zeal, but not the talent for administering pain. Plus, he had no big cause or belief, just one part personal dementia and 2 parts anxiety brought on by the desperation of his predicament. In this entire enterprise, Fitzroy decided, perhaps only Court Gentry was more imperiled than young Lloyd. Fitzroy presumed Laurent would likely order this regal fellow to kill the American lawyer if the contract was not signed by Julius Abu Bakr tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Sir Donald, for his part, was beaten up but certainly not beaten down. He had a plan of sorts. He intended to use his wits and his tradecraft and a lifetime of experience manipulating those around him to achieve that which he could not accomplish alone. Though confined to a bed, Sir Donald Fitzroy planned cruel revenge on those who dared cross him, his family, and his top assassin. The door to the master bedroom opened slowly. Fitzroy downed the last of his brandy and placed the snifter on the bedside table next to him quickly. Claire entered warily, unsure. Then she saw him and ran across the room to her grandfather. She hugged him tightly around his thick neck.
"Hello, darling. How are you?"
"I'm all right, Grandpa Donald. You're hurt."
"A little spill on the stairs, love. No worries. How is your sister?"
"Kate's fine. She likes it here."
"You don't like it here?"
"No. I am afraid."
"Afraid of what?"
"Of all the men. They are mean to us. Mean to Mummy and Daddy."
"Are you behaving yourself?"
"Yes, Grandpa Donald."
"That's a good girl."
Fitzroy looked out the window for a moment. Then he said,
"Claire, my dear, I'd like to play a little game. Would you like that?"
"A game?"
"Yes. One of the men here, watching over us. He came with me in the helicopter this morning. I've heard his mates call him by the name Leary, an Irishman. Do you know which one I'm talking about?"
"With the red hair?"
"That's my girl."
"Yes, Grandpa. He sits in a chair down at the bottom of the stairs."
"Does he now? Well, Claire, I notice Mr. Leary has a telephone clipped onto the pocket of his big blue jacket. I don't suppose he wears his jacket in the house. It's probably in a closet, on a floor, maybe lying on a sofa downstairs. I was thinking that maybe we can have a bit of fun with Mr. Redhair, and you can sneak around like a little kitty cat and slip the phone out of his jacket. Do you think you can do that?"
"I saw his jacket on the coat rack. I saw the phone. When he goes into the kitchen for tea, maybe I can take it."
"That's a good girl. Please try to do that for Grandpa Donald. After you get it, I want you to hide it in your pocket or in your sweater, and then tell the guards you want to come see me."
"What if they won't let me?"
"You could tell them you are Kate. Can you pretend to be Kate? Tell them your sister got to come see me, so it's only fair."
"I don't look like Kate, Grandpa."
"Trust me, my dear. To these men, you look exactly alike. Just change your clothes, tell them you're Kate, and you'd fancy a chat with your dear old grandpa."
"All right. I will try to steal a phone for you and sneak it back."
"Well, it's not stealing. It's just a game, love."
"No, it isn't. It's not a game. I'm not a little kid. I know what is going on."
"Yes, of course you do. I thought you might. Please, don't worry. Everything will be fine."
"Where's Daddy?"
Fitzroy's pause was short, his countenance unfazed. Sir Donald had been lying to his agents for nearly half a century. He found it no big trick to lie to his kin.
"He's in London, love. You'll be home soon as well. Run along now, and go carefully."
Chapter 23 Court parked the van at the main train station in Geneva, the Gare de Cornavin, located on the seedier north side of the city. Parking at train stations was simple tradecraft. When the vehicle was found, which Court had little doubt would take no time at all,
His followers would have to entertain the possibility that he'd just jumped on the first set of wheels rolling out of town, causing them time and manpower to investigate where he might have gone. It wasn't much, but parking at the train station at least avoided the obvious tell of pulling his stolen vehicle up to the front door of his true objective.
The weather was cold but bright,
and the last of the late autumn leaves blew across the wide streets of the city. From the station he walked south, past the afternoon street whores and the sex shops of the red light district, over the bridge crossing the canal into huge Lake Geneva, passing middle-aged bankers and diplomats heading towards all those street whores and sex shops behind him. 5 minutes south of the bridge, the wide and modern streets gave way to uneven cobblestone passageways, and the chic shops lining the roads morphed suddenly into medieval stone walls as a steep hill rose away from the modernity and towards the ancient, picturesque buildings of the old town. Gentry consulted a tourist map hanging on the wall of a hotel lobby, hid his scraped and swollen left wrist from the Japanese couple next to him, and then returned to the chilly street. Another minute or two of climbing an alley brought him to the square in front of the Cathedrale Saint-Pierre. There, Saturday afternoon tourists stood, heads and eyes and cameras all pointed to the thousand-year-old cathedral's impressive facade. Court walked behind the two dozen or so sightseers, then melted down a side street that ran along the south side of the church. On his left was a white wall 6 feet high, with a large iron gate in the center. As he walked past the gate, he glanced inside. There was a white house with a small front garden, a large chestnut tree on either side of a narrow walkway to the front door. The trees strained for light in the shadow of the Cathedrale Saint-Pierre that loomed high in front of them. Court walked down a cobblestone passage that ran off the little one-lane street, followed the winding footpath through a narrow tunnel that led him down and around to the back of the White House. Here, the wall was 2 stories high. Modern structures stood alongside it, an apartment building with a nail salon on one side, a nursery school on the other. A few tourists wandered towards a narrow shopping street that ran farther down the hill behind. Gentry saw the watcher immediately. An attractive woman with long, braided blonde hair, she sat at a picnic table in a little playground alongside the shopping street. Court was 25 yards from her, but her eyes were on the White House to his right. Gentry turned, walked back through the foot tunnel, followed it up and around towards the white wall of the White House. There was an iron handrail built into the wall to aid pedestrians with the steep incline of the passageway.
Court stepped up on this and, with his good right arm, pulled himself up on the top of the wall.
He kicked one leg and then the other over and dropped down, letting his good left leg take the majority of the impact with the ground. Still, the one-handed climb and the drop hurt like hell. Inside the small garden, Gentry saw the security system through the glass. He knew how to circumvent all sorts of countermeasures, but this looked too sophisticated for him. He'd need schematics and tools and time.
Court moved low below a window, rose again at a side door.
He drew a Beretta pistol he'd picked up on the platform shortly before fleeing the scene, left there by a dead Swiss municipal policeman. He held it low by his side as he tried a side door. It was unlocked. He entered a hallway and then a well-appointed kitchen. The lights were off, and he could easily make out the sounds of a television in the next room. The glowing set reflected off a mirror in a hallway on the other side of the kitchen, and Court used the flickering light to make his way. He saw a pistol sitting on the kitchen counter, a full-sized 1911-45 caliber, an American's gun. Gentry crossed the long kitchen carefully. He hefted the weapon and slid it into the back of his pants. His swollen wrist rewarded the movement with a hot jolt of electricity up to his elbow. Court moved into the hallway, rose confidently now, and entered a wide living room. A plasma screen hung above a large fireplace that crackled with pine logs. A lone man sat on a leather sofa with his back to Court. His eyes were trained on the television. The language coming from the TV was French, but the images were clear enough to Gentry. Less than 2 hours earlier, he'd stood on that same train platform. He'd spoken to that young policeman who now lay face down and dead on the snowy cement, the video images catching the moment when a yellow tarp was draped over his still form. Court holstered his gun. There was no one else around.
"Hello, Maurice."
The man stood and turned. He was pale and wrinkled, easily 70 and unhealthy-looking. If Gentry's appearance in his flat was a surprise to the old man, he made no sign of it. He stood on thin legs.
"Hello, Court."
American English.
"Don't waste your time looking around," Gentry said. "I have your gun."
Murray smiled.
"No, you have one of my guns."
The old man pulled a small revolver from under his shirt and leveled it at Gentry's chest.
"You don't have this one."
"I didn't figure you for the paranoid type. You weren't so careful in the old days."
"Even so, you should have kept your weapon trained on me till you knew I was unarmed."
"Apparently so." The old man hesitated several seconds. The revolver did not waver.
"Damn, boy. I taught you better."
"You did. I'm sorry, sir," Gentry said sheepishly.
"You look like shit."
"I've had a rough couple of days."
"I've seen you after rough days. You've never looked this bad."
Court shrugged.
"I'm not a kid anymore."
The old man regarded Gentry for a long moment.
"You never were."
Maurice turned his revolver around in his hand, tossed it underhanded across the room to the younger American. Court caught it, looked it over.
"38 Police Special Snubby. The other one's a 1911. You do know, Maurice, that there is no law that says that just because you are old, your guns have to be too." "Kiss my ass. Want a beer?"
Gentry tossed the revolver underhanded onto the leather sofa.
"More than anything else in the world."
2 minutes later, Court sat on the kitchen counter. He held a fat bag of frozen blueberries over his left wrist. The cold burned his skin, but it reduced the swelling. He could still move his fingers, though, so the hand was functional, if barely. His host was Maurice. Just Maurice. Court didn't know his real name, could only be certain that it was not Maurice. He was an old agency man, Gentry's primary instructor at the Special Activities Division's Autonomous Asset Development Program Training Center at Harvey Point, North Carolina. Court only knew tidbits about the man and his history. He knew he'd cut his teeth in Vietnam, performed targeted killings in the Phoenix program, then spent the next 20 years as a Cold War spook in Moscow and Berlin. He'd been demobilized for years, working as a trainer for the CIA when a 20-year-old convicted murderer was brought into his prefabricated aluminum classroom within sight of the Atlantic Ocean. Gentry was both cocky and quiet, raw beyond belief, but in possession of intelligence, discipline, and zeal. Maurice turned him out in under 2 years and announced to operations leadership that this kid was the best hard asset he'd ever built. That was 14 years ago, and their paths had seldom crossed since. Maurice had been lured back into the game after 9/11, as were most high-level retired assets still in possession of a pulse. Because of his age and uncertain health, he was sent to Geneva to work in the finance end of the CIA's Directorate of Clandestine Services. His knowledge of Swiss banking and bankers accrued through 40 years of utilizing numbered accounts for CIA shell corporations in his operations, made him an effective paymaster for operatives and operations around the globe. It was easy work, clean, compared to some of the jobs he'd done as a younger man, but it was not without danger or controversy. Shortly after Court had been drummed out of the agency, Maurice himself was cashiered by the brass. Something about misappropriated funds, though Court did not believe the official story for a minute. The word from Langley was that Maurice was now completely retired from the CIA. Court did not know that for sure, wasn't 100% certain Maurice wouldn't turn on him, which explained the pupil's initial suspicion of his teacher. Maurice handed Gentry a bottle of French beer, so the younger man cradled the frozen bag of blueberries in his lap and let his wrist rest upon it. The stinging cold slowly numbed the ache. The old man asked,
"You hurt bad?"
"Not really."
"You always were a tough bastard."
"I learned from the best not to whine.
It never worked around you.
I haven't seen you in 6 years.
Cyprus, was it?
Yes, sir.
You saw the watcher outside?
Yeah, girl with the braids.
Good boy.
She's pretty good, dressed like a tourist.
We get a lot of tourists here in the old town. I hate tourists.
Transitory faces.
That's right. Do yourself a favor, Court. If you make it to retirement, move someplace so godforsaken no tourist would ever set foot there.
Will do.
Maurice coughed, cleared his throat.
There's news floating about. Not connected yet, just bouncing around in the ether, waiting for dots to be connected. Prague, Budapest, and then this morning up by the Austrian border. I knew something big was going down. Didn't figure I knew any of the players until the coverage on my house started about 11:30.
About an hour after she showed up, all the local stations began broadcasting the news of the gunfight just north of Lausanne.
At that point, I knew you were heading this way.
How did you know it was me?
I connected the dots. A hunted man who just kept on living. Death and destruction in his wake. As the bodies got closer, I told myself, here comes Court.
Here I am,
Gentry confirmed distantly, looking at the bottle in his hand.
Tell me you didn't shoot those poor cops.
You know me. I wouldn't kill a cop.
I knew you. People change.
I didn't change.
The police were holding me when a wet team showed up. I tried to convince them I was no longer their biggest problem. They wouldn't listen.
A lot of people want you dead, Court.
You aren't exactly the flavor of the month yourself. The CIA burned you, too.
There's no shoot-on-sight directive against me. You were the one they really fucked over.
Still, how they framed you was wrong, Maurice. You were one of the honest ones. They should have left your reputation intact.
Maurice said nothing.
What are you doing these days?
Court asked.
Finance, private sector stuff. No more spook work.
Court's eyes scanned the expensive real estate around him.
You look like you're doing okay.
There is money in money, or haven't you heard?
Court detected a little defensiveness. He swigged his beer and rotated his arm to spread the cold around his swollen wrist.
You remember a guy at Langley named Lloyd?
Sure. Sharp-dressed little fag, law degree from London, King's College, I think. He got in the way of a finance operation I worked in the Caymans not long before I got shit-canned. Smart kid, but a prick.
He's at the center of all this stuff I'm dealing with now.
No kidding. He was like 28 at the time. Must be only 32 or so now. He left Langley about a year ago, I heard.
What happened to all the good guys?
Asked Court rhetorically.
Before 9/11, we were a basket with a few bad apples. After 9/11, we grew into an orchard. Now there are enough bad apples to fill baskets.
Same shit, different scale. No surprise.
They both sipped beer for a minute in silence, relaxing in each other's company, as if they spent every Saturday afternoon together. Maurice started to cough, and his coughing morphed into a violent hack. When it ended, Gentry asked,
"What's wrong with you?"
Maurice looked away a moment, answered without emotion.
"Lungs and liver, take your pick."
"Bad?"
"The good news is I may not die from the lung cancer, because the liver disease may get me first. Conversely, I may be buried with a working liver if I can only die from lung cancer. Drinking and smoking 50-some-odd years."
"Sorry."
"Don't be. If I had it to do over again, I wouldn't change a thing."
He laughed, and this turned into a raspy coughing fit as well.
"How much time do you have?"
"There's an old Henny Youngman bit. Doc says, I've got 6 months to live. I tell him, I can't pay your bill. He tells me he'll give me another 6 months."
Maurice's laugh turned into a wheeze and then a violent hack.
"So 6 months then?"
"That's what they said. 7 months ago."
"Don't pay him,"
quipped Court. It was gallows humor, though Gentry wasn't comfortable joking with his mentor about impending death.
"Let's get back to you. What have you gotten yourself mixed up in?"
"It's related to a job I did last week. I pissed someone off, I guess." The colored guy who got hit in Syria? Ali Baba, whatever his name was? That was you, wasn't it?
Abu Bakr, court corrected, but he neither confirmed nor denied his involvement. Maurice just shrugged.
He needed to go. I followed your career as a private. Your ops are always white on black. Not just nicely performed, but moral.
Just. Tell that to Lloyd.
A lot of people say that thing in Kiev was you.
That's what they say.
So?
Maurice's phone rang. The old man reached a reed-thin hand to the handset on the wall and answered it. His gray eyes widened slightly as he looked up at his young guest.
It's for you.
Chapter 24
Shit.
Gentry took it.
Yeah? Court, it's Don. What do you want? They don't know I'm calling. I got Claire to pinch a phone from one of the chaps guarding the chateau. She's a right chip off the old block, is she not?
Gentry gritted his teeth. Maurice handed him a fresh bottle of cold beer.
What the fuck is your problem, Don? Claire is not some Belfast tout. You can't run her like one of your agents. She's a little girl. She's your family.
Desperate measures for desperate times, mate. She was brilliant.
I don't like it.
Do you want the intel I have or not?
How can I use anything you've got? How do I know you still don't...
They killed Philip Court. Claire did a runner. The bastard shot my boy as he went to look after his child.
Jesus Christ. We can only hope. I'm sorry.
Court paused.
How did you know I was here?
Lloyd knows you're in Geneva.
Figured the shootout on the way from Zurich might tip him off.
Quite. I racked my brain as to what you were doing there. Knew you were too smart to approach somebody in my network. Then I remembered there was an old agency banker in Geneva. Used to be SAD. Ran hard asset training. Figured you must have had dealings with him in your former life. I called a few contacts and got a number.
How are you able to make phone calls without them knowing about it?
They think I've given up. I'm lying in a bed with stab wounds and busted teeth from that fucking poof Lloyd. He tried to rough me up, did a cock-up job of it. Can't even torture a man respectably. They have me pegged as a half-vegetable, a compliant old shell-shocked nutter in bed upstairs. But I haven't given up, Court. When I thought the only hope for my family was to make you dead, that was my intent. I'll admit that to you. Now I know bloody well the only hope for my family is to get you here. To help you in any way I can to hit this place as hard as you can with everything you've got.
Just keep the girls out of it from now on. Can you do that? They're just kids.
You have my word.
Lloyd really does have the documents he says he does?
He has your CIA personnel file. A couple dozen others, too. Papers and computer disks. He brought us down from London to add another enticement, to make sure you'd come.
Why is he doing this?
Fitzroy told Court all about Lauren Group, about Abu Bakr's demands, about Regal and the Minsk Guard Force and the pavement artists, about the gauntlet of a dozen hit squads from a dozen intelligence agencies in a dozen third world countries, all sent after him for the $20 million bounty. As Sir Donald relayed all the information he had about the operation against Gentry, Maurice pulled a blue box from a cabinet and brought it to the kitchen table where Court was seated. The aged financier and former clandestine services operator cleaned the cuts on his young protege's wrist with antiseptic, then squeezed bags of cold gel to force a chemical reaction, turning the compresses frosty white in seconds. These he wrapped around Gentry's swollen left wrist, followed by a compression bandage to hold everything in place and prevent further swelling. It was a tight, neat job, executed by someone who had obviously been trained to tend to the wounded. When Fitzroy finished his report, Court said,
I can't believe they go through all this just for the contract. I get it, $10 billion is a lot of cheese, but for Abu Bakr to confidently make a demand like this, I've got to think there is some other motive in play here.
I agree. The shootout with the Swiss cops, that's an incredible risk for a company like Lauren Group to take, even if they did it by proxy with Venezuelan shooters.
Gentry said, There is more than just a contract at stake. Look into that, okay, Don?
I'll talk to Regal. He's a bit more lucid than Lloyd.
Good. Keep that phone with you. Ring her off.
Any way I can contact you while you're on the move?
Gentry looked up to Maurice.
You wouldn't have a spare sat phone just lying around I could buy off you.
The older man laughed, disappeared down a long hallway, a fresh coughing fit almost doubling him over at one point. Moments later, he returned with a satellite phone. It was a high-tech Motorola Iridium, a model Gentry knew well. Used by spies and soldiers and high-risk adventurers, it was not much larger than a regular cell phone, housed in a clear plastic case that was shockproof, waterproof, practically bombproof. Court nodded appreciatively as he took it. The number was written on tape on the back, and Court read it off to Donald before slipping the device into his front pocket. After he recited the number back, Fitzroy paused a moment, then said,
"Court, my boy, one other thing. When this is all over, when you've killed every last living thing that is a threat to you, I'm going to contact you and give you an address. It will be a tiny, out-of-the-way place that will be easy for you to slip into and out of without worry. You will find a little one-room cottage, and I will be in that cottage, sitting in a chair, stripped to my undershirt, with my hands flat on a table, and I will be waiting for you. My neck will be bare. For what I have put you through, for what you have done for me, I will give you my life in recompense. It will give you little comfort, but maybe it will help you. I am sorry for what I have done to you in the last 48 hours. I was desperate. I didn't do it for me. I did it for my family. Save them, and I will go to my death to give you a measure of peace. Court, you still there?
Keep the girl safe, Don. Do that one thing for me. We'll settle up the rest when this is over. Gentry hung up. After Court handed the phone back to Maurice, he finished his second beer. Wiping his fingerprints from the bottle with a rag from the counter, he walked to the rear of the home and looked through the long curtains.
When I leave, can you handle the watcher?
She's just sitting there. I think I can manage that. I'm not dead yet.
You'll outlive us all.
Coming from you, son, that's not particularly comforting.
He changed his tone. More fatherly now. He asked,
How can I help you? I've got to do a thing in northern France. Have to get up there and engage by first thing tomorrow morning.
You're in no condition to...
It doesn't matter. I have to go.
You need some money?
A little, if you can spare it.
Of course, I can float you some cash.
What else do you need?
I'll take the 45, if you've got a few more mags. Maurice chuckled, hacked. The sickness in his lungs seemed to grow with the conversation.
You'd probably just hurt yourself with a big manly weapon like that. They don't make 'em like they used to. That's my baby. I'll get you something a little more contemporary.
I was hoping you might have a bug-out bag that you staged for a rainy day. I've got nothing, so any gear you could spare would be much appreciated.
I've got an SHTF cache a couple of blocks from here, in case the shit ever hit the fan. From what you're telling me, I'd say your situation qualifies.
I really appreciate it.
Anything for my best student.
Maurice disappeared down a back hallway. He returned a minute later with a sheaf of euros in an envelope and a key on a chain. He wrote an address down on the envelope and handed it to his protégé.
I think you'll be pleased with the gear.
Court pocketed the items.
Another beer?
I'd love one, but I'd better get moving.
Understood.
Maurice poured several anti-inflammatory pain pills from a bottle in a cabinet into Gentry's hand. Court downed them with the last swig from his bottle. Then they walked together towards the back door.
Court said, I wish I could say I'd see you again. If I make it through tomorrow, I'll have to drop off the face of the earth for a while. Maybe if you don't pay your doctor's bill, we can have another beer someday.
Maurice smiled, but this time he did not laugh.
I'm dying, Court.
No sense in putting lipstick on a pig. I can't make it any prettier than it is.
Is there anything I can do for you? Anybody you need me to see? Look in on after you're gone?
There's nobody. No family. No friends. There was just the agency.
I know the feeling,
Court said. Spending time with his mentor was good in that Gentry had so few opportunities to talk to someone who'd gone through some of the same things in life as he had. But it was also bad, depressing, because Court saw a measure of himself in the tired, old, cynical eyes of the man facing him in the living room, and knew that, though no one likes to get old, in Gentry's profession, mere survival was the absolute best one could hope for.
And this was success.
You can do one thing for me, Maurice smiled as he spoke. When you get yourself extracted from this mess you're in, I want you to get away to some tropical island somewhere. When you read in the paper about an older-than-dirt disgraced American banker dying in Switzerland, I want you to go out to your favorite cantina, find yourself a pretty girl, and drink the night away with her. I'm serious. Get through this and get out of this life. There are still corners of the world where no one gives a shit what you've done. Go there. Meet somebody. Live like a human. Do that for me, kid.
I'll try.
Someday you will learn. All the things you've done, all the things in the past you thought were dead and buried, you think you've put them behind you, but you haven't. You've just stored them away, stored them for the time when there is only you and a quiet room and your memories and the goddamn demons of those you killed.
I've got to go, Maurice.
I know I can't stop you from doing what you have to do, but think about what I am saying.
All the shit I taught you back at Harvey Point.
Sooner you forget what I taught you then, sooner you follow what I'm telling you now, the sooner the killing and the death will be dealt with.
End of sermon, kid. They shook hands.
Court's game face reappeared in a flash.
He crammed the wad of cash into his pants pocket and the sat phone into his jacket and headed for the back door. He peered through the blinds out the front window, into the medieval passageway. Instantly, he sensed that something wasn't right.
"What is it?"
asked Maurice,
picking up on his protege's unease.
"Check the back. See if the girl is still there."
Maurice walked down the hall to the back living room and called out to Court.
"She's gone."
"They pulled her."
"Who pulled her?"
"Hitters."
"Because they want her out of the way when it goes loud?"
"Exactly."
"They're here?"
asked Maurice as he returned to Gentry's side.
"Not here, but close," confirmed the gray man. "I can fucking smell them."
Gentry's eyes narrowed.
"Tell me you didn't set me up, Maurice."
"Not on your life, Court."
A moment's pause.
"I believe you. Sorry."
"Who's out there? Any idea?"
Court and Maurice barricaded the doors with an armoire and a bookcase.
"God only knows. In the past 3 days I've had everyone but killer Martians on my ass."
"This must be the killer Martians, then. I hear they're real bastards. You can get out through the ceiling. There are boards in the crawl space laid out to a vent. Push the vent out, and you should just about fit through. This will drop you into the attic of the preschool behind my house. They are closed on Saturdays. They have a basement that leads into the nail salon next door. You look like you could do with a manicure, but try to fight the urge. Slip out their front door to the Rue de Purgatoire, then down the little alleyway.
Rue d'Enfer.
That should get you clear."
"What about cops?"
"The closest station is at the Palais de Justice, but we aren't talking front-line troops. Better we don't call them at all, lest a bloodbath ensues."
Gentry stood motionless and just stared at Maurice. The elderly man laughed heartily, fought his wheezing.
"I set the escape route up long ago. For me, back when I could have managed. I had a neighborhood boy test the crawl space just a few months back. No problem." "Go on, then."
"Come with me."
"You aren't getting my feeble ass into that crawl space. I'm not running from anyone."
"Now go." "Maurice, in a few seconds an Alpha team is coming through those doors. They will know you helped me. They'll do whatever it takes to get intel from you."
Marie smiled, shrugged.
I've never been afraid of dying, Court. But the thought of dying for nothing really chaps my ass. If I'd taken a bullet back in Nam like every goddamn friend I had back there, then it would have been worthwhile. If I'd died on the job with the company, that would have been honorable. I mean, depending on what we're doing at the time. You know what I'm saying? But sitting here in my house in Geneva, flipping channels on the television and waiting for the moment my lungs cough up or my liver pisses out, there's just no nobility in that. What are you saying? I'm saying I'll die for you, kid. You've done more righteous hits than the entire damn agency in the past 4 years. You deserve someone to help you when you're down.
Gentry did not know what to say, so he said nothing.
Don't fuck it up, boy. Get out of here. I'll slow them down. Maybe bloody a nose or two in the process. No promises, but I'll try to thin their ranks a bit.
I'll never forget you. Marie smiled and pointed upwards.
If I get past security and make it up there to heaven, I'll put in a good word for you with the man. See if I can't save your scrawny ass in the afterlife, too.
An awkward hug between two men whose minds were tightening for impending action. Maurice said,
One more thing. I hope you will remember me in a positive light, not think bad things about me if you should learn that I made a mistake or two along the way.
You are my hero. That's never going to change.
Thanks, kid.
There was the sound of a truck's brakes out front.
Go!
Gentry nodded. He squeezed the frail man on the shoulder and leapt to the rafter overhead without another word. Quickly, he pulled himself up and into the attic, his broken rib and his swollen wrist both shrieking with pain. He had just replaced the tile when a crash at the front door knocked the armoire a foot into the room. Maurice spun around and moved into the kitchen as quickly as his old legs and scarred lungs would take him. Another impact cracked the door behind him. He grabbed hold of the huge commercial stove, yanked the old gas appliance back a few inches with a jerk. Desperately, he reached behind the stove, stretched his aged body to its limit, but he could not take hold of his objective. He looked around the room for something to extend his reach. The South Africans were commandos from their nation's National Intelligence Agency. The leader of the six-man squad stood in the front yard of the White House, his Benelli shotgun resting on his shoulder, as the rest of his team finally made entry on the barricaded door. They moved in a well-practiced tactical train throughout the two-story building. They split into two units in the middle of the first room. One team went into the kitchen and found an old man sitting at a table, hands on top of his head, fingers laced, facing the far wall, the image of submission. The first man in the train pulled him down to the floor roughly and searched him in the narrow breakfast nook. He found a pistol in the old guy's waistband and threw it up and into the sink.
"That gun is an antique, idiot!" said the elderly man as two South Africans shoved him roughly back into his chair.
They dragged him and his chair into the main room and waited until the other four members of the unit pronounced the rest of the house clear. When the entire team reformed around their prisoner, the old American looked at all the faces.
"South Africans," he said, obviously having heard their accents.
The leader asked,
"Where is the gray man?"
"Look at you guys."
Maurice ignored the leader's question.
"Three black, three white. Ebony and ivory. Back in the old days, you whiteys would be beating down on you darkies, wouldn't you?"
There was no response.
"You white boys must miss those apartheid days, huh?"
The leader repeated himself.
"Where is the gray man?"
"Ah, but the head of the operation is white. You boys still roll like that? The plantation owners put the slaves in the big house, but they still give the orders, am I right?"
One of the black operators unhooked his Uzi from his chest rig and raised it to smash its butt into Maurice's jaw.
"Stop!" shouted the leader. "He's just trying to slow us down so his lover boy can get clear." "Won't work, old man. Now, where is the gray man?"
Maurice smiled.
"This is the part where I say, who is that?"
The leader's eyebrows furrowed. He spoke in a thick Afrikaans accent.
and this is the part where my man hits you across the face for giving us an attitude instead of an answer."
He nodded to the black operator still poised above him, and the Uzi's squat butt smashed into the old American's jaw, sending his head snapping back.
"Now, fucker, let's try again. Where did he go?"
Maurice spat blood and a bit of his bottom lip on the floor in front of him.
"I don't remember. I have reached the advanced age where the memory starts to falter. Very forgetful, you understand. Getting old sucks."
After several seconds of waiting, the leader shouted into the man's face,
"I will not ask again. The gray man was here. Where is he now?" "Sorry, young man. I'm unwell. You mind terribly if I use the restroom?"
The leader of the assassins looked to his subordinate.
"Hit the fucker again,"
Maurice said immediately.
"He is gone, and you will not find him."
The South African sneered at the thin man.
"I'll find him. I'll find him and I'll kill him. The gray man's reputation is nothing but a load of hype."
Maurice laughed and coughed.
"Do you have any idea how many men who said that very thing are now rotting away eternity in a pine box?" "That ain't gonna be me, mate."
Maurice nodded appreciatively.
"I will have to concede that point to you. There's not going to be enough of you left for a pine box. But not to worry. I hear mortuary services here in Geneva are exceedingly diligent. With a little luck, they may salvage a blob of you big enough to half fill an urn on your mother's mantle."
The South African cocked his head.
"What the hell are you talking about, you nutter?" "I'm just saying, your future looks bleak, pal. But there is good news."
The South African looked around to his men. He was clearly speaking to a crazy old buzzard.
"I'll play along, chief. What is the good news?"
"Your bleak future will be short-lived."
Then Maurice smiled. He softly began a prayer asking forgiveness for his sins. Just then, the text voice came over the radio. The six men put their hands to their earpieces to aid their hearing.
"Watcher 43 reports the subject just came out of the nail salon a block behind the house. He's on foot, heading west."
The leader of the South Africans nodded, turned his attention back to Maurice.
"Good news all around, Granddad. We won't have to torture you to find out where he's going."
Maurice did not look up from his prayer. The South African team leader shrugged his shoulders, lowered his shotgun to the seated man's chest, and fired one-handed. As the slug left the barrel in a shower of fire, the South African lifted into the air and flew backwards into the kitchen. His neck snapped, and the skin burned from his face and hands. The other five suffered similar fates, though in the confines of the living room there was less open distance for the men to fly. Maurice died instantly from the 12-gauge blast to the chest at close range. Firefighters on the scene minutes later would recognize the telltale devastation of a massive gas leak, probably from the connection between the wall and the big industrial oven. This was an unfortunate but all too common occurrence in old homes like this one, and was hardly a surprise. Only hours later, when the fire had been doused and the water and foam levels lowered to where the bodies could be examined, were the investigators scratching their heads. The seven bodies, soaked and burned beyond recognition, gave them little information. But the massive amount of firearms surrounding all the victims, save one, was highly irregular in peaceful Geneva, to say the least.
Chapter 25.
5 minutes after exiting the nail salon, the gray man walked west on Rue de Marche, searching for the address on the note card in his hand. A light rain began, blurring his view of the numbers on the buildings. He'd just turned north on Rue de Commerce when an explosion roared behind him. He stopped in his tracks, as did the pedestrians around him on the pavement. Unlike them, however, Gentry did not turn around. After a few seconds standing motionless in the rain, he took a step forward.
The momentum returned to his body, and he continued on,
his head and shoulders slumped a little lower. He spotted a watcher, so he dodged into the Rue de Rhône, a small, covered passageway, where he lost his tail in the foot traffic near the McDonald's. Minutes later, he found the single-car garage in the back of an underground parking lot below the Rue de la Confédération.
It was a Saturday afternoon.
No one was around, and the key Maurice gave him unlocked the sliding door. It opened with a creak, and the dust from inside the unit